Welcome, welcome, welcome to Binary Jazz, the show that is more like balderdash than a podcast. I'm your host, one of your hosts, Chris, Jazz Sequence on the Internet. I am joined, as always, by Gary, who is Binary Gary on the Internet and is also a trainer of, he's a falconer. Amateur and professional and regional. And also Allison, who is Allison Plus on the internet, who is the manufacturess of a shop on Etsy that produces small beds for Burmese cats.
They're super comfy. Come and check us out.
Yes. It's Burmese cats on Etsy.etsy.com.net.co.
Gary's currently checking to see if that domain is
definitely available. And I just registered a new domain.
Okay.
Viral traffic. I'm excited to see you all. I have to share a wacky dream I had with you.
The dream is with us.
Please do, Gary.
I wasn't with you in the dream. I had a wacky dream that I would like to share with you. Was that the proper amount of pause before the with you? I hope so. I was watching golf on this past Sunday while my infant daughter slept on my chest. I'm not like a huge golfer. I just happened to be the thing that I wanted to watch on Sunday, and the rare Sunday afternoon I had the TV on. So this dream last night that there was a green, which is like where the pin is with the hole. But it was only like 4 inches with this little green, tiny, surrounded by this like entire huge sand trap. So it would be nigh impossible to land a ball on the green. I'm not sure what the point of it was, but I was totally fascinated in my dream with it as I kept like circling to try and understand how one could potentially put a golf ball in this hole on this green. Probably all sorts of metaphors and stuff of that nature. I just think it was funny and interesting, and I was imagining like many golfers standing in the sand, hitting and sand flying everywhere and totally missing the green and having to hit from the sand over and over and over. So that was my wacky dream. I would draw a picture of it if I could, but
that'd be a par nine
podcast. It would even be possible. I can't imagine. I mean, it would be dumb luck, you know, dumb luck. You'd land your ball on the green, either in the hole or close enough that it would not roll off. How would you do that? It would be nigh impossible, as I said.
I thought a lot about it.
Not a lot. I was entertained in my dream. I mean, it was like in the dream. That's cool. So here we are.
Here we are.
Here we
the
are.
Sand trap of life.
Was that an appropriate amount of stalling, Allison?
It will do. I'm semi pleased and semi just all over the place. Okay, so this might be a bit scattered, but bear with me.
Such is life.
To continue with the less of a define and more of a puzzle trend. Interactive fiction and gaming, at what point, how much interaction is needed for something to be a game? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I feel like you'll both have opinions. And how much is like, if it's just a simulation versus just like a walking simulator?
A walking simulator?
Well, yeah, like a...
That sounds terribly boring.
Just get on that treadmill and keep on walking.
It's like
our metaphors walking. Today are terrible.
But it's not actual walking. You think you're walking on a treadmill, but you're not.
Without any of the benefits of a treadmill. But basically, yeah, like at what point does it transform into a game where you're like that form of interaction versus just a simulation?
Okay, so the first thing that I think of when I think of interactive fiction is Choose Your Own Adventure.
Yes.
And that is not a game. It is game-like, but it is not a game. It's not a game for me because I am not, I mean, I'm making choices.
Because I take it seriously.
I do too. Dude, I'm very serious about my gaming. It's
adventures.
Yes, and Choose Your Own Adventure. I did tons of them as a kid. And it's game-like in that you're making choices that determine the outcome of the story, but the story is already written. Similarly, I think that there are video games that follow a Choose Your Own Adventure-like narrative, which are generally less fun because you don't get to control, you don't get to determine the outcome. You're following along this path with like a few like pivot points that, you know, determine, you know, if I go down this fork or go down this fork or whatever. So I would say that that's the least interaction.
So you want the free range versus like you're given three options and each one of those branch to.
Yeah, but there's a double-edged sword there too, because if you do too much, if it's too open, if all a game is just like an open world for you to do whatever, with nothing to tie things together, then that's not fun either. That's like
Second Life.
Yeah. Right. I mean, there's lots of things. I was thinking of a game that was a Kickstarter a while back, which has a really interesting thing. I might have talked about it on the podcast before. I might have just talked about it before. Called Code Spells, where the point of the game is it's one of those things that encourages coding. It's got like this scratch like interface for building spells like that you can use in the game. So like you can, I don't know, make you're given a couple like base sort of template spells that your character can cast, and then you can write your own spells, and that's the cool thing. But when I last played it, and it was still in development, and it might be better now, but when I played it, that's literally all there was. You're a wizard, you can write spells, it affects your environment, but there's nothing to interact with. So like, yeah, I can build a lake right here, and that's cool. Okay, you can build a crater and then fill it with water and then set the water on fire or whatever, but there's nothing to interact with. It's just like, boop, that's a cool thing. Mm-hmm.
I am what the industry would call a casual gamer. I'm not really like hip with what's like current and exciting. And if somebody spent some money on Amazon advertising and it caught my attention, I'd probably, you know, like, oh, that looks like a neat game. And it maybe, you know, an outdated idea and yada, yada. So I'm certainly not as regimented in my beliefs as far as what qualifies as a game. I think, I don't know, like kids all the time, like, you know, do you want to play a game with me? What do you want to play? Let's play, like Lego Star Wars, like not like an actual game, but like, here are some Lego characters. Like it's not a game. We're inventing a world and, you know, I don't know, I feel like it's necessary of language correction at that point, but the concept of game, like, you know, the broader idea that children often have, I think is for me, I'm happy with that definition.
My kids are constantly playing various iterations of what's essentially just live action role playing. It's like, it's gone through various iterations. It started off being called a Real Ninjago, where they were playing characters from the Lego Ninjago series. And then that evolved to Real Minecraft, or maybe Minecraft Live. I'm not sure what they called it, but same idea, except now they're in Minecraft world. And that's evolved into something else, but it's often informed, even when it is within these sort of contexts, it's often informed by other pieces of media. So like we read audiobooks, and there's a particular series, the Frontier Magic series, which is really, really good. Allison, you should check it out. It's basically the Old West, if there was magic. So it's all about like westward expansion in the early United States with magic and magical creatures and things. And there are different schools of magic that represent various, you know, types of magic that came from different parts of the world. And the Evrupan magic is what most Americans, except they're not Americans, they're Colombians, because it's the United States of Colombia. Because most of us immigrated from Europe, that's what we, and it's all like weird names because they're based on things. And so, but there's different schools and they come from different places and there's arguments about which is better and whatever. So anyway, where I'm going with this is the kids will bring those magical schools into their storytelling. They also had, there was a period of time after we watched the Miyazaki movie Nausicaa, where they would bring in things, they bring in Nausicaa the character, but also like things from that movie would make appearances in their storytelling. And it's just, it's always been really sort of fascinating what things kind of stick and how they explore those things.
The I find like mine, like it's other media informs the gameplay, but real world experiences and like interactions with other children make their way into, you know, pretend play. I kind of want to go the other direction though, entirely. Like thinking about like walking simulations in general, right? What was the one you ran on DOS? Lemonade Tycoon? It wasn't Lemonade Tycoon. Lemonade Stand.
Lemonade Stand.
Right?
Yeah. I was actually looking at that not that long ago.
Yeah. So in that case, like, is that a game? Because the only element of randomness is, like, the weather and the cost of produce, right? You're really, like, it's really, you know, business management wrapped in a funny story. And that narrative obviously still exists plentifully across pocket games for, you know, mobile devices, and I find those pretty enticing. Like one of my favorite game studios out there is one called Nimblebit, and their games are not challenging. They do like Tiny Tower, and there's several takes on Tiny Tower, like Tiny Tower Vegas, and they partnered with Lucasfilm before Disney bought it, maybe, and did Tiny Tower Star Wars, and they've done Pocket Planes, where you know. Build a network of, or build an airline network across the world, and they're not challenging because there's always constant growth. Like you can't quote unquote lose, right?
I feel like this is where we should cut to a sponsorship. Now word from our sponsor: you can't lose with.
I guess where I'm headed with that though is like, what's the purpose? Like, what is the purpose of gaming? Like, when I'm playing a game like that, it's often been in the middle of the night and I'm, you know, shuffling around the house carrying an infant that's nearly asleep, but I am not, you know, and it's a one-handed game and there's not much thought or logic that goes into it. And it's not littered with advertisements and it's just, you know, pleasing visuals. But it's borderline on being a game based on our current definitions, because there's not, you know, not a lot happening. Whereas, you know, Lemonade Stand, I don't know.
I mean, I don't think winning or losing necessarily needs to be a criteria of whether or not a thing is a game. I can go down the role-playing game wormhole and like that role-playing is a game. It's a thing that you do. There's no winning or losing unless you consider your character dying being a loss, but then you just make a new character and you keep going. There's no winning because, I mean, yes, you accomplish things, and maybe you gain fame, notoriety, experience, whatever, but there's not a completion point other than one dictated by the whoever is running the game, the dungeon master or whatever. Just saying, okay, we're done. But it's not like, you win! Congratulations, here's your prize.
But it also goes into that thing of like, what's more impactful? Is it media as escapism? Or is it like that relatable kind of narrative journey, maybe. Because like there are times when I just want to tap a thing and stare at a wall, and that's great. And it's still a game. But then there are other times when I'm like, I'll be just totally immersed in a story of some sort, and that's a lot more important at that point.
Well, I think, yeah, and so games, I mean, obviously there are solo and multiplayer games, and I think some of that escapism, right? Like some of the fun of escapism is doing it with other people, you know? And there's certain games that the game itself does not have a lot of value. Like there's this game I used to play with my uncle, and it was called, what was it called? I don't know what it was called. But you ran, like, effectively you ran a railroad, and there was an east side of the board and a west side of the board, and the game wasn't very well written, because if you were the east side, you had to go up the mountain, and you ended up catching a lot of demerits because you were always late because you got stuck behind a freight train moving slowly. So, I mean, like, the way to win the game was, like, sit down on the west side. Like, that was how you won. And we knew that, and we accepted that for years. Yet we still played the game because the conversation was good and entertaining, and we made silly jokes, and, you know, it was like a comfortable spot to lose reality for a bit and be, I don't know, train dispatchers. It was called Dispatcher. Yeah. By Avalon Hill.
I think to go back to the original question is, at what point does interactive fiction become a game? I think it comes down to the amount of choice that you have. You have to be able, like, there's a certain breaking point after which, okay, now it's a game. Like, the choose your own adventure stories were not games. Things that are, but I mean, I guess at the converse is, there are things that are currently defined as games now that are don't even fit that criteria, which means that I'm an asshole to those game developers, probably, because I don't think that they're games, apparently.
It's okay, our listener.
Our one listener.
You know, that's a sidebar. This is a great way to avoid, like, angry email, is to have a listener. You know?
I'm the listener, so if you haven't received an angry
email from me. That's my point. Like, you haven't sent, like, a nasty email yet. Like, you jerk, ..
I can't believe that you derided my whole industry.
You know, I previously thought of myself, like, as not a gamer, and I even said that earlier. So, but the more I think about it, maybe I am, like, that casual gamer that the industry likes, because I do spend money on games, and, you know, I don't know. I definitely think of people that are majorly into board games. Like, I think of that as, like, a nerd subculture, right? Like, I say that, like, in a respectful way, but I mean, it is, like, a subculture, you know? And I mean, Chris, it's awesome. But and we've had, like, long gaming conversations in our Slack, and I have looked at and added items to my wish list based on our conversations. And I don't know, like, thinking more about gameplay mechanics and that kind of stuff. And you know, there's something to that exercising your brain in that fun sort of way that is cool. And I don't know, I'm definitely big on the loud, boisterous community games. They typically tend to be card games. Like, that's my jam, you know? But I can definitely see myself getting into more, I don't know, more, those are generally shorter running games, you know, like 30 minutes or less. I could see myself getting into longer games with the right people, you know? Because that social aspect, I think, is what makes it fun.
When we pulled the kids out of school and started unschooling, which is probably a topic for another day, we knew that much of the education the kids would be getting would be through games. I mean, we were already gamers, and the kids had already shown interest in not just, like, casual board games, but, like, really detailed. Like, dude, my son's been a fan of Catan since he was, like, 8. I mean, and that's the thing that he wants to do, and more power to you. That's a really hard game to get behind. It's a really long game, and it's kind of tough to say, yes, we'll play Catan, because it takes so damn long. But every opportunity he has to pull out Catan is an opportunity that he will take. And so that's awesome. And we've built a rather obscenely large collection of really cerebral, like, games that are just sort of at the edge of what, I mean, we're beyond the point where like the little age thing has like recommendation on games has any meaning whatsoever. Like we're far past that. And so we're like edging into like just further and further at the end, you know, at the end of what would be something that they can handle and yeah, I mean, we just push up those edges and they, you know, come along. We pulled out, a few years ago, I got a game called Seven Wonders and we opened it up to play it that first day. I got it for like Christmas or something. And we pulled out to play it and we tried playing it and the rules just, it didn't make sense to me and it didn't make sense to the kids. And it was just, okay, we'll just put this away for a while. And so we pulled that out recently because it's been a couple years. I'm like, yeah, let's try this again. And like, that's the thing. Like that's our new thing. And it's interesting because like, it was really, really difficult to just wrap my head around the rules at the time or like how the thing progressed. And now it's like, yeah, this is it. I mean, everybody's on board and we're playing it with grandparents and the kids are helping explain how the thing works. And yeah, I mean, it's,
Do you think having played two more years of exceedingly more complex games, it led to the
it's also like, you know, every time we get something, we look at like not just like the recommendation, but also like, you know, how like what we know of the game. We look at reviews and sometimes we'll watch Tabletop or whatever to see like how it actually plays out and determine based on that whether we think this is like more or less complex, because like sometimes they're off in either direction, right? Sometimes they're way too 13 plus whatever, and it's like, well, it's not that much different than this other thing that we play all the time. I do think that playing that, like putting it away for a while and then they come and then playing other things and coming back to it having had the context of other games during that 2 year period or whatever, it definitely made a difference.
Do you think that, in the interest of totally not answering Allison's question, do you think that augmented reality is going to be like a major shift in the way we do tabletop gaming?
You mean like what Apple wants us to think it is?
Well, right before we started this episode, to directly not answer your question, right before this episode, I was on some site and somebody had taken the old Nintendo game Street Fighter, right? But you can play it in augmented reality, so you can have like Street Fighter played like in your backyard, right? Like 3D characters in your backyard. Okay, that's not really my grind. Like I'd probably be more into like the Ninja Turtles running around my backyard, but still, like the video kept me entertained for at least 30 seconds before I killed that website and went and did something else, you know, squirrel. I guess that is a question. Apple's pushing it hard, but it's Apple technology. Like it's going to be a thing. It's not, the concept is not difficult, right? So you expect it to come to Android.
I would love for augmented reality to be a thing that trickles down to board games. I don't think it will. I think that the audience of people who play board games like things that are tactile. That's part of the board game experience. And the audience of people who like games on their phone like virtual. So the thing that makes augmented reality cool, in my opinion, is the fact that you've got this virtual world interacting with your real world, but you're not personally interacting with your real world. So it's not like there's going to be an augmented reality version of a board game of Catan, where everybody's got their phones and you've got a board in the middle and everybody's looking at their phones to see the board. I don't think that's going to be a thing that happens. Will it mean that we can all get together and like that demo at the whatever Apple released last, where they had like a table and then they were showing it and it's like this big war thing, you know, like, will there be things like that? Sure. But I don't consider that. That's not like a tabletop game. That's maybe a game that's on a tabletop, but it's not, you know, it's not a board game. And I don't think that's going to affect
board video game first.
I augmented reality is interesting, but it hasn't been nearly as interesting as I have wanted it to be. I've played Ingress and I played Pokemon Go, and I'm anxiously looking forward to the new Niantic augmented reality game about Harry Potter, where you're a wizard. Because, dude, wizard.
Because we all want to be a wizard.
Why would I not want to be a wizard? I
mean, man. What's the currency?
I could patron the hell out of that.
What's the currency in the Harry Potter universe?
What do you mean?
Galleons.
Oh,
galleons.
Go to Gringotts for them.
And nuts? No, am I thinking?
Yes. Yes. No, you're not nuts.
K-N-T-S. I was like, am I? I was wondering about getting mixed up in Lord of the Rings somehow.
No, my son is reading Harry Potter right now for the first time, and he was we're at dinner and he's like, "What are cunts?" Like, I'm sorry. Where did you read that? And it was Harry Potter, and I was immediately more relaxed. But there was a moment of sheer terror at the dinner table. And I couldn't figure out what media I had exposed him to. Oh my God, what media had I exposed to? Like, what was going on until he showed it to me in Harry Potter.
So I like that. First of all, I like dinner table discussions at your house. If they're at all related to Harry Potter, it's a good sign. But I like that you immediately sank into like a fear paranoia of like, What did I expose him to media-wise that brought this forward?
I won't say that we filter all media that he's exposed to.
Well, that would be an outlier of being like, we should track down where this came from.
Yeah, I mean,
wait,
but we are.
What Harry Potter book is he on?
Just the first one right now, actually. Yeah. So this is like a new experience because he wanted to read it because my sister, his aunt, was like, oh, I bet you're ready for Harry Potter. So he's like, can I read Harry Potter? Can I read Harry Potter? I'm like, sure. So I pull out the Kindle, and I obviously have it on the Kindle, and I'm like, great. This is my Kindle, and this is how it works. And it's not like you're used to where you can, like, remember your page number, because he doesn't want to dog ear things, so he remembers the page number he's on, because I would totally, I'd close the book and be like, oh, man, was that 94 or 49? We're never going to know, you know? But he can walk around all day with like 176 in his head and come back and open 176. So you know, we talked to the Kindle and stuff. So it's fun to see like that interaction, and if he wants to, like, he likes to go back in books and recover ground, you know, and like make sure he understands. So in the Kindle, he's tapping furiously, and you know, it's fun to watch.
The audiobooks are also very good for Harry Potter if you're an audiobook person. Choices involved.
It probably depends on which one. We found an audiobook recording by, oh crap, I can't remember who it was, but it was good. Yeah. There's an actor that I knew whose name I've completely, not David Attenborough, but it's some other British.
It's a David Attenborough-ish person.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
We'll put it in the show notes.
When we figure out who it was, it will be
like,
sure.
That's, yeah,
but there's other Harry Potter narrated, there's other narrators that are not as good, because I think I got some of them that had that person and then some of them that didn't, and it was better.
Yeah. He just has like such an appetite for the written word. We get in the car to go somewhere, and like that for him is permission to open whatever he's reading and get to it. And to the point where we get to where we're going, and it's like you have to break into that bubble. Like, hey, close your book, get out of the car, we're here. So and sometimes I get frustrated with that, and I need to remember like that's pretty awesome that
yep.
that he has that relationship. And and then the other thing is I don't remember who said it. Probably someone well-known and famous, but I think I heard it from a friend that's an English teacher, that when you hear someone mispronounce a word, that's cool. Like, it means they learned it in a book. So, like, I love that.
Wow,
I, like,
that I love means that I'm thought. Really cool.
Well, I mean, I love that thought process,
all
right?
The time.
Especially given the context of our last dinner conversation. But I love that context, right? Like if they're mispronouncing words, like, they read it. Like, they didn't. It wasn't like something they heard or presented to them, right? Like they struggled with it. And there's, I don't know. I think there's value in that. Like, you know, I don't know.
Aaron always gets on me about saying partesian.
Partesian.
It's like artesian, except with parties. Yeah.
Oh, I like that a lot. I prefer that. But I do, like, I grew up reading lots of, like, sci-fi fantasy, and as a result, like, but not talking about it, just because there was no one to, like, talk about it with, I guess, beyond a certain point. And so, like, names of characters and weird like high fantasy is a perfect example of that, where it's like the Wheel of Time series. And then when I finally met someone who had also read it, and then we were just like, wait, you say it like this? And I'm just like, no, but in the index in the back, they show that you pronounce it like, but it's like, yeah, those things that are like Hermione from Harry Potter.
Sure.
I feel like there was a huge long like debate on how to say her name.
I read books to the kids at night before bed, and names suck. As well as words that I've never heard out loud, that also sucks. But names are just awful, and like, yeah, I had a really hard time. We were going through it was the Aragon series we finished a little while ago, and there's some names in there that's like,
I feel like as long as you're consistent with the bad pronunciation, that's all that matters, so that they know it's the same character.
Yeah. But yeah, to go back to your point about the kids getting sucked in a book, my daughter has started doing this thing where she can't go to sleep without reading before bed. And so for a long time, we'd go to bed, we'd say, okay, good night, whatever, we'd leave, turn out the lights and go downstairs. And she would turn the lights back on or be reading with a flashlight, like in her bed. So we've compromised and said, okay, we'll do bedtime stuff. And then you have 20 minutes and we'll come back and we'll let you know. And then it's time to actually go to bed. So that's her nightly routine. Like we read to both kids in both rooms, and then we leave and we go downstairs and do something else for 20 minutes, and then go upstairs. Okay, time to go to bed. Lights out. Boom. And that has
worked.
But it's the same sort of thing where it's like, it's really hard to pull her out of a book. I mean,
I want to know three things real quick. One, my blood pressure is rising as we've reached the timer. Two, you read underneath your covers as a kid with a flashlight, though, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
So I hear, and the third thing is a story about that. Oh, no, the second thing was we have totally completed an episode without even remotely trying to answer the question. Nicely done. The third thing, when I was a kid.
Get tempted.
I didn't. I wasn't even close. I didn't even participate in that part of the conversation. So nicely done. Thank you, Chris, for carrying the show today. I finished a book, and I had bunk beds, and across from the ladder was my bookshelf. But I knew that if I climbed down the ladder, I had to go past the door to get to the bookshelf, so like the length of the door. And my parents were in the living room. So I tried to reach out from the bunk bed to put the book I'd finished back and grab another book. And I fell, feet like bang into the bookcase, and I hit the ground, and books are showering down on me, and the bookcase is rocking and spilling crap off the top of it. And I remember my dad standing like in the doorway, and I'm on my back looking up at him, and he's like, don't you think it's time to go to bed? Not like, damn it, what the hell are you doing? Or are you okay? But
it's time to go to bed.
that's an excellent segue into if we have any questions. Do we have questions today, Allison?
We do.
Don't you think it's time to go to bed?
Yes.
Okay, so crosswalk timers.
Oof.
There's a countdown already happening on that crosswalk, and you're running late, do you cross, or do you risk being late, or do you risk your life?
Risk my life, obviously.
Yeah, this question is tough. Like, it depends on the city. Like, there's a lot to inform this.
It does, because some cities, like, at the end of that crosswalk timer, like, when it goes to the flashing hand, then the signal turns yellow then, so that when the hand is solid, then it's a red light. But other cities, like, it does the flashing hand, and then the hand stops flashing, and then the signal turns to yellow.
And some cities, drivers are aware of crosswalks because there are so many pedestrians. And so, like, in Jacksonville, like, I barely walk in a crosswalk when it's green because... I mean, people just get like gonna crank a right-hand turn and cream me, you know.
Right.
In Atlanta, Georgia, totally. I mean, like it's flashing, like that's still permission to get in, like to start. So, yeah. Yes, risk my life in Atlanta, but not in Jacksonville.
Have you ever met someone famous, and or who is your favorite encounter if you've met more than one famous person? And famous could be a pretty broad. It could just be someone that's like admirable and well known to you.
Okay, so there's this one time I used to go to collect baseball cards. This isn't like my favorite, but this is just how much celebrities are assholes, really. sort of my favorite encounter, I guess. I used to go to collect baseball cards, and my dad and I would go to baseball card shows. And one time we met Mark McGwire as he was like, because he was at the show signing autographs, and then he was leaving, and they had a game that day. And so my dad says, you know, good game, or have a good game, Mark. And he's like, yeah, whatever. Another asshole baseball player experience is Orlando Cepeda, who was a pitcher for the San Francisco Giants a long time ago, Hall of Famer. Anyway, he was also signing autographs at my school, which was a Catholic school. And so they had this whole event that they were doing, and then he was there at the event signing autographs. And I had a Giants ball that I wanted him to sign, and he refused to sign my Giants ball because he had to sign balls that were being given at the thing that had some bank on them.
I can't think of any meaningful interactions with celebrities or anything of that nature, but I did as a kid go to a lot of spring training baseball games, so I'll just provide a counterpoint on baseball players. Spring training is a totally different
that they're not all thing. Assholes.
Yeah, so like the Blue Jays did their spring training in Dunedin, which was like 30 minutes from my house. So there were several times where we would skip school. My parents would take us out of school. We'd go to the Dunedin Blue Jays spring training game. I remember the players were always just like so polite, and they'd sign anything, and they were happy to come and chat. And they always, like, there was a kid on the side, they would always come and chat with a kid and like, you know, keep practicing and one day you can play, you know, in the big leagues. And
so wait, here, the lesson though is that Canadian baseball players are nice.
You know, maybe that is the lesson, perhaps. Perhaps. Dunedin is a huge Canadian wintering city.
I will say that my interactions with Real Salt Lake soccer players have always been positive.
There you go.
Oh, here's a good one. A football player that played in Jacksonville that was just cut from the team yesterday, actually, a guy named Alan Hearns. We met him at some event at the stadium and took a picture, Tyler and I, with him. And he was just a super stand-up dude. And the quarterback for the Jags and previous head coach spent some time with my sister and her family over a couple years. I guess sports people
don't have to all be good. So sum up, some people are garbage and some people are fine.
Yeah. That was... I kind of killed that, Chris. I should have just let you go with it, man. And now we're less than a minute, and I'm a total... Is there a third question that has, like, a one-word answer?
Not that I can fit in less than a minute. These are quality.
Yeah, that's fair.
And with that, we will wrap up another episode of Binary Jazz.
Ooh, we can't leave on that note. That's awful.
Yeah, we can. Oh, yeah. No. Yes, we can.
You're like, I'm the guy that's editing the audio, so we're going to. It's done. Now we're in extra innings, as it were. Oh, man.
You don't like my announcer voice?
It's like a touch Vincent Price.
Yeah, it was a bit disconcerting. Made me uncomfortable.
That's fair and also appreciated.
You're like, mission accomplished. Okay. Do you remember Cones of Dunshire from Parks and Recreation?
Oh, yeah. The game
yeah, I wanted to make a reference to that, but I.
But you just I did.
There yeah. You.
Extra innings references. Yeah, there it was. Good game.
This isn't less than a minute at all. They're just liars.
No, I know. We were at 2 minutes and it went to less than a minute.
Thank you for listening to Binary Jazz. If you like this episode, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or Google Play. You can visit us online at binaryjazz.us or follow us on Twitter at @binaryjazz. Don't forget that you can ask us a question through the form on the website or on Twitter, and we'll read it aloud on the next episode of Binary Jazz.